I would like to first say The Selected Poems of Donald Hall is a book of the poems that you selected as probably maybe this last representation of your poetry. And it must have been quite a challenge out of all those poems you've written all your life to pick out so few.
Yes, it is tiny compared to what I published, but I hope that the less is more. And I knew it would be the last, you know. But the last selected poems I did, which was 2005 or so, I put in far too many poems. I more or less put in everything where I found something I liked.
Right.
Instead of poems which you might go on to learn or all sorts of things. And so I spent a lot of time going through my work and making choices. And I just looked through just an hour or so ago because we were going to talk. And I'm pretty happy with my choices. And I don't feel, I don't feel really bad about things I left out. And it was kind of a surprise to me that I wanted to do this. I wanted to do some sort of selection because my last huge selection was out of print, and I didn't like the idea of being out of print. I hope this poetry being out of print.
Yeah, that's probably one of the worst things a writer can say about themselves is I'm out of print.
Yeah. I hope this one hangs around for a while.
Well, I suspect it will. You didn't write an introduction, but you wrote a little note for us afterwards. I guess you can say an afterword. And in that you said, some of the poems from the day I wrote them have remained uppermost in my mind. Which of those poems in this collection just had to be included? They just wouldn't let you not include them.
There's one longish one. It's too long to read aloud at readings. It's too long to be anthologized. And probably it's the latest poem that I wouldn't have omitted. But it's the first one that comes to my mind when you ask the question. It's called Kill the Day.
And yes.
It's probably the last poem that I wrote.
Wow.
It was all about the death of my wife and the grief that I felt. It turns up in a few later poems. But this was a poem that I began only 2 or 3 years after she had died. I'd written a whole book of poems about her disease and death, one called Without. But I came on a kind of depression after her death. I grieved horribly, and I had moments when I went up. But this was a time when I had a kind of depression which felt violent and aggressive. And it was very disturbing. But I walked up and down one morning, writing lines after line after line, with great necessity and urgency, and I had written a draft of this poem. And I think it was twice as long as the poem as printed.
Hmm.
I had to cut. There was a repetition. There were bad patches. There always are. And I used the form that I had used in another poem. I had a long poem called The One Day, and there is a section from it printed here, something called Prophecy. And there's a 10-line stanza of which the contents are not metrical, but it is like a pentameter line. I don't keep the syllable count. I don't keep the count of anything except lines, you know, the numbers of lines per stanza. But it had a rhythm to it and a kind of drive to it that the earlier poem made me think of. And the other poem, the original poem I'm thinking of, is called The One Day. And it's The One Day. And it's a book-length poem. But I realized that I was following it when I wrote Kill the Day. And by repeating the word day, I was connecting the two. But that's too long to read or anything.
Right.
It's occurs to me when you speak of it. There were a few others, and many of them have to do with Jane's death and my mourning.
You know, Kill the Day is really a beautiful poem. It's one of the ones that I underlined several places. But what the interesting thing about it is, you wrote about Jane's death, the poet Jane Kenyon, after she died, your wife, she died, and for 5 years you were writing poems about her.
And this is
according to what you just said, like maybe at the midpoint. The interesting thing about this poem is that it doesn't use the first person.
Yeah.
It uses the third person and refers to the speaker of the poem as a he. He closed her eyes in the noon of her middle life. Why did you make that choice, or was it the poem that chose it?
One thing that occurs to me is that by suppressing the capital letter I, I may have turned the reader away from the sense that I am whining, waiting, I am putting myself forward. If you use the I in such a poem, you have a kind of, you know, a palm tree farm of all those eyes sticking out.
Right.
You look at the page visually, you see the eyes everywhere. And I did a similar thing with the poems about Jane at the beginning. I said he instead of I. And actually, it was something recommended by a poet friend. I sent a draft, and the word I was all through it, and sort of drawing attention away from the subject that I was looking at. So I changed it to he. And everybody reading it knows who he is.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it was very clear.
So I went to the same strategy when I wrote this poem.
Well, that's
there
interesting.
There are other poems from that time and poems of mourning where I do use I, shorter poems.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad I asked you that question because what it means to me, if I'm understanding correctly, and even if I'm not understanding correctly, it's teaching me something, that distance allows you to get a little bit emotionally closer to the subject without seeming sentimental. And you have this line in the poem, you have this line in the poem, which I underlined because I think it's so beautiful, but I also think it even further separates the subject from the person. It says, there is nothing so selfish as misery, nor so boring. It's a nice line because it allows me, again, to read this poem without it seeming like it's an indulgence.
Yeah, good.
You write in one poem, in The Alligator Bride, you write this wonderful line, and the line is, the sky is a gun aimed at me.
Yes.
And that line just won't let me go. I mean, I just love it on so many levels. And I'm wondering if, like the poems that won't let you go, are there certain lines in your poems that just stay with you and that you just kind of are still in love with and maybe even would include a poem because of those lines?
Yes, I believe so. Hard for me to come up with examples.
Right.
Partly because I'm 87 years old.
And you've written a lot of poetry.
I do remember that. And lines that sort of saved a poem. I mean, I had a kind of urgency and necessity to write about it, but it wasn't until I found a particular line or a trick of grammar or something at the end of it that I felt that it flowed together. There's a poem called The Man in the Dead Machine. I begin by talking about a plane wreck, a World War II airplane.
Okay, yes, that was the beautiful image of that kind of carcass of an airplane in a field somewhere, I think.
Yeah. And but all the way through it, I say the plane, the pilot, it's all third person until the last stanza where it becomes first person.
I flew and back to the carrier.
You realize, or you understand it, that the poet is telling a story about his own feelings.
Right.
And toward the end, the feeling becomes so intense that he reveals himself by using the word I. I don't think, you know, it seems narcissistic or mental there. It's a kind of pressure of the story and the allegorical meaning of the story that presses first the first person. And there was something I published the poem with the third person throughout. The New Yorker did it, and I liked it. I read it aloud. And I had done this many times. I revised a poem after I published it. I was driving from a poetry meeting to an airport, and it suddenly occurred to me to try the word I. And it was a big change. And so I typed it out with the word I and sent it to all my poet friends. And have I really made this better? And they, or most of them, liked it, the change I made.
I'm talking to Donald Hall, whose book, The Selected Poems of Donald Hall, just came out, and it's a fantastic collection. When you and Jane Kenyon lived together in that ancestral home that you often write about,
yes,
and that's often a source of your poetry, you would write poems, and then you would exchange poems. You would give her your poems, and she would give you hers. And you said that you didn't give her early drafts. You said that's a bad habit. Wait until it solidifies.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
I learned that. I mean, I did show all my poems to poet friends even before I knew Jane. And the problem with showing it right away is somebody talks to you about it, and whenever you look at the poem, you remember that other person.
Oh, yeah.
Words. And it's best to spend your time secretly on the poem, and you make all the little changes. I do things like crossing out a word one day and putting the same word back in the next day. And I find that I need to concentrate, and I don't want another person's point of view to rise to my mind when I look at the poem.
Oh, that's...
It will happen if I showed it to somebody. And there were occasions when Jane and I had 20 years together in this house, and she arrived here as a talented young poet, and then she got better and better and better. And we would almost always wait 2 or 3 months working on a poem. And then one morning Jane would say, "I left some stuff on your footstool." Suddenly Jane would disappear while I was reading them. And the same was true the other way around. I can remember one time when she came down with a single poem that she had written almost that day and gave it to me. Only one time. And that was a wonderful poem called Otherwise. And at the end of it, it's a whole poem. I had been very ill, and she wrote a poem. People read it thinking she was writing about her own illness, but she was writing about mine, actually. And she said, the poem with the word otherwise sprinkled through it. And then at the very end, she writes in the poem, "One day it will be otherwise." It's all about a cup.
Wow.
And but when she first showed it to me, it said, "One day it may be otherwise." And I got her to change "may" to "will be."
I'm talking to Donald Hall, and we're talking about early drafts, how it's a bad habit for a poet to write a draft and immediately send it off for people to read. I mean, I always knew it, but I love your explanation that if you do that, when you start revising, when you re-enter the poem, you can't help but have that voice telling you, you know, something that may really fight against the poem and fight against, you know, maybe what your own impulses are. We had Mark Strand on the show, another former poet laureate of the United States, and I asked him about his writing process, which, of course, I'm going to ask you about, too. But one of the things he said is that he doesn't write a first draft on a computer or a typewriter, and he said the reason why is because it almost seems visually like it's already done. And so what he does is he writes it out just longhand without line breaks. And then, you know, eventually he starts to do that. I'm wondering, in your process, how do you start a poem? And what is the impulse for a poem for you? Is it syntax? Is it image? Is it some feeling?
Yeah, it's feeling. And a kind of welling up of feeling. It's like a flooded yellow river. It gathers height and force. And I think this may be a poem. whether it has some subject or not, at first, many times I have written a poem with great urgency and concentration, thinking I was writing about one thing, and then discovered later that I was writing about something else entirely, or mostly something else at the same time. Poetry is, by its nature, for centuries and centuries, something that can hold together North and South, the opposites. The 17th century is full of such poets. And the thing is that human minds are like this way. Even the human mind wandering the world doesn't really understand that something is perfectly or exactly true. If you write a love poem, there is, and the love poem will not be a pure thing. There will be something in it which is about the death of the lovers or about an antipathy within the love. There's no such thing as a perfect love in itself, and the poem doesn't represent it that way. I remember several times in a poem thinking that, well, it can't be any good because it all goes in one direction. There's no counter movement in it. And then later, finding it. There's a poem called Gold. It's on the back of the jacket here, which is a love poem. And I thought at first that it was intensely loving and sensuous. And it went nowhere else. It was all one line, straight ahead. And therefore, it couldn't be any good. And then I noticed that at the end of the poem, I killed the lovers off. One day, their bodies were tied in their graves, more or less. So I had intense loving, sensuous loving, and then I killed them all. That was enough of the loving someone in this life with great intensity. You would have the same, I know, but we're alive.
I think I understand what you're saying, and when I look at a poem like To a Waterfall, really a very funny poem. Sometimes you come up with some pretty funny poems. And this
I know, rarely, but I love doing it.
And this is an example of one of them. Essentially, I'm going to go ahead and summarize the poem, although trying to summarize a poem is like trying to summarize Beethoven's Ninth. You can't really do it, but I'm going to go ahead and try anyway. It's about, you know, basically a poet being on a plane, and when you travel a lot as a poet to do readings, you run into a lot of businessmen. And it has, by the way, one of my favorite lines. One of the businessmen asks what he does, and he says, "I'm into poetry." "Oh, yeah," they say, "developing an interest in clouds." Love that line.
Yeah.
But this poem, you deal with the businessman, then you deal with their wives and how their wives are getting their books signed and, you know, receiving you and feeding you little sandwiches, and then you go to the Holiday Inn, you being the speaker of the poem, of course. But the last stanza suddenly addresses a second person, a you. It says, "What about you, you laughing, you in the blue jeans?" And it's referring to the offspring of the mother and the father. And it just kind of subverts the whole meaning of the poem, subverts it emotionally and subverts it dramatically. And I'm wondering, are poems best when in the end stanza or in the end lines there's some sort of subversion or twist?
I think it's often toward the end, You go in one way and then suddenly you twist back on the poem and reveal that, everything is not as it seems. In fact, it's the opposite.
Right.
That in itself could be funny. Of course, it could always be heart-wrenching. And poem that is intense in one direction and then finds that it has over-insisted or something it needs to correct itself.
Yeah. One of the things that I think a lot of poets have trouble discovering, and perhaps you've struggled with this as a young poet, is knowing when the poem is finished. How do you know? I mean, you revise so much, probably more than any poet I've interviewed.
I've been asked that, and I found out that with a long life in poetry that I don't know. I think I know. I don't publish it until I can't think of it anymore to do it. But then, when I reprint, well, one thing I've said, I hate it when a new book comes in the mail, because the minute I open it, I will see something. And I've done 4 selections, and in each one of them, I made changes in poems that I have published, and sometimes even poems that have been around for many years. Mm. And when I do that, I check it out with friends, as I did with the Man in the Dead Machine, because you could make terrible mistakes that way. In fact, when I was going through the poems in the selected poems. I changed two or three anyway.
Maybe really?
And there was one poem about Jane where I tried to change it, and apparently I was doing terrible things. I believe I was. I tried out changes on friends, and they all said, leave it alone. And I decided they were right.
Borges said in an interview that he cannot read even one of his books. And maybe that's one of the reasons why, because he's like, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that. I should have done this. And he would want to start revising it.
That's what a good one of selected poems is for. You can change your whole poems.
Yeah. That must have been an exciting process, is entering into these poems. Because when you enter into a poem, you really are entering into, on some level, a landscape. You're entering into a place. Enter into a poem and feel around, like Billy Collins says in his introduction to poetry. You're creating a place. And it must have been challenging emotionally, but also rewarding emotionally, to re-enter these landscapes, both emotional and physical, that you haven't entered in a while.
When you read over the poem, you enter it again, and you are in the process of writing.
Yeah.
And the poem, even if it's an old poem, and you may see, find a way to do it better. I don't think many people change a poem from book to book.
Right.
Others do, too. I love to do it. I've been looking at the selection of poems right now, and I don't have any ideas about changing it.
Right.
A good thing, because I'm 87 years old, and I can write as well as I used to. And I'm happy to find something that resists change.
Right.
And that seems to work.
And when you enter into those earlier poems, you're entering into the emotional and psychological landscape of an earlier version of you. Do you ever feel the urge to tell the younger you something? And if you would, and if you could, what would you advise yourself when you were a younger poet?
Sometimes I say, shut up. One of the early poems in the book, it was written when my son was born.
Oh, yes, My Son the Executioner.
That's right.
I love that poem.
He's 61 years old now.
Wow.
And he still likes that poem. but I remember, seeing him come out of the nursery, just born, and the astonishing fact that my child had red hair. I was so taken by the red hair when the nurse carried the baby that I forgot to ask at first what flavor he was, whether he was male or female. Anyway.
You were an editor of the Paris Review, and when you were in that position, this was, of course, many years ago, you interviewed a lot of poets.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, was there a question that you always returned to that you just wanted to ask every poet?
I don't think that there was. Maybe, if I were looking at them, I haven't read those interviews for a long time.
Right.
T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound and Marianne Moore. And they were so different. And I remember Eliot was the first. I knew him a little before I interviewed him.
T.S. Eliot?
I thought of one question I wanted to ask him. I'm just sort of telling you my favorite question. And I saved it for last. I wasn't sure how he'd take it. And the last question I asked him was, do you know you're any good? And he said, no, heavens no, no one good knows whether he's any good. And he changed it a little bit in the going over the interview. But I did like that one. I don't think that I asked the same one.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a question that you asked T.S. Eliot. But I'm going to change it a little bit. Were you a good poet?
I hope so. I don't know. And sometimes I think so. Oh, when Jane and I were here, I would get to work on poems before she did. And I would come out from my study and see her maybe reading the paper. And we made much of this. Sometimes I came out and said, I am immeasurably great. And other times I would come out, say, I am disgusted. And each time I meant it, and each time I knew I didn't know what it said.
Well, I think you're one of the best poets ever, and I love this book, The Selected Poems of Donald Hall. Donald, thank you so much for joining us. I'm wondering if I could dare ask you if you'd be willing to read a short poem from this collection.
Yeah, this is an old poem, but it's one where I love the sound of it. I love to read it aloud. Mount Kearsarge.
And you write about that mountain. That mountain appears in a lot of your poems, how it's just right there out the window of your ancestral home, every generation, every day.
Yep. Here it is. Great blue mountain ghost. I look at you from the porch of the farmhouse where I watched you all summer as a boy. Steep sides, narrow flat patch on top. You are clear to me. Like the memory of one day. Blue, the top of the mountain floats in haze. I will not rock on this porch when I'm old. I turn my back on you, Kearsarge. I close my eyes and you rise inside me. Blue ghost.
Donald Hall reading a poem from his The Selected Poems of Donald Hall. Thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
I've loved talking.